Hello and welcome to Tech Radio here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Keely Boltina, filling in for host Ken Osborne. On today's show, we talk about which social network is sopping up almost an hour of your day, hear how tech trends are shifting among major players in computers, tablets, and more, plus a special excerpt from a conversation on cybersecurity after a conference in Sioux Falls. Of course, our panel of tech experts, Amos Asaf, Joel Brovelite, and Jeff Litterick, is also here to answer your questions. Those stories and more ahead on this Friday's Tech Radio. First, the news. Welcome back to Dakota Midday Tech Radio. Kent Osborne is out today, but the computer guys are here. I'm Keely Boltina. Our regular panel of experts joins us from our studio here at the University of Sioux Falls. So we'll say hello to Joel Brovelite, Apple expert. That's what I call you every time.
Yes.
I mean, is that an official title?
Or guru.
Guru. You like guru better.
Well, Apple that's just guru. Usually what Kent says.
Okay. So
either way.
Both
Either
work.
Way.
All right, sounds good. Well, in the spirit of Kent, Apple guru, Joel Brovelite. And then also in the studio with me is Amos Asaf. He's a senior solutions architect for Exigent.
Yeah.
And I got that one right, too.
Yeah, nice work.
Wonderful. And we should have Jeff Litterick on the phone from Peer. He's a technology integration specialist with the state of South Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Yep. Hello. So.
Hi there. Great. I love it when technology works on the technology show. It's just a beautiful thing. So if you have questions for our panelists about any of the topics we encounter or whatever you come up with, you can call, email, or check out Tech Radio on Facebook. So the phone number is 800-524-3604. You can email midday@sdpb.org, or you can find us on facebook.com/techradio. So we have quite a few things that we can talk about today because a lot is happening in tech and computer and science-related fields. But I wanted to start out with Facebook because it's always up on the tabs on my screen. And I saw that yesterday, you know, they had this amazing first quarter of net income of $1.5 billion. But then they also had this statistic that people spend 50 minutes of their day on Instagram, Facebook, and Facebook Messenger, which I just think is incredible that 50 minutes, like that's almost 1/24th of your entire day. And 8 hours of that is presumed sleep. Like, I don't know. It just boggles my mind. Is this something? Do you expect it to be more or less? What?
Well, you know, Facebook being one of those things that. There I am. Facebook being one of those things that is a. You know, I'll check it quick this morning just to see if I've got any messages. But then you find easy ways to get sucked in, and there's more stories, and there's more messages, and you scroll down, and it's just a never ending. List of what you would assume would be interesting stuff, right? Because these are your friends, in theory, and
right,
and so there's always more things to look at. I think it's one of the reasons why you know it's blocked in many many businesses because it's a time waster. It's a time suck, really. It pulls time away from other things that you should be doing, and. I could definitely see it wasting at least 50 minutes, that's for sure.
So even though you don't realize you're wasting 50 minutes on it or spending 50 minutes on it, when you do those quick checks throughout the day and you stay in that app or on the screen longer than you realize, right. It just adds up.
You know, and I wonder how they calculated that 50 minutes because, you know, if you were to check Facebook at any point in time, it appears as though I'm on simply because my phone has the Facebook app on and is always looking for, you know, updates or posts or something like that that may have tagged me. So sometimes I wonder if those are all completely accurate. But it definitely does take time.
Well, and the article that I was looking at in the New York Times says things like people spend time reading every day 19 minutes, 17 minutes in sports or other exercise, and social events they spend about 4 minutes on average per day on. So to put that against 50 minutes on Facebook just kind of stuck with me. So,
well, you know, I mean, you can split that time out. You know, everybody goes to the bathroom, everybody waits in a line. Everybody waits for a meeting to start. Everybody waits for their kid to come from school to the car or whatever it is. So I think that's where all that time is. Whereas before we might read a book or you
or
know, play
talk
a game.
To each other.
Huh.
That would be
I'm
weird.
Trying to think of anything but that, really. Even if you're by yourself, you know, there's always those little slices of time, and I think those get eaten up with social media, and you know, I think the things other. You know, similar activities have gone by the wayside.
It's just so convenient being in your pocket.
Sure, totally. And I would like to see a statistic how much of that is mobile. I'd bet most of that's mobile.
Sure. Well, and it's kind of like when a couple of years ago that statistic came out that all of, or the study came out that, that we're wasting so much free time. We have more leisure time than ever before, but they're counting things like driving in between home and work where you can't do other things or, mm-hmm. you know, that we don't
where
usually
you shouldn't
consider.
Do
right,
other
right,
things.
That's true. Where waiting at red lights is not really leisure time for most people. So that makes sense. Jeff, do you spend 50 minutes on Facebook? Just curious.
No. Even less on Twitter anymore. I spend probably 15, 20 minutes on Facebook each day reviewing stuff. I don't really include the time I, you know, see news articles and I open up and actually read the news article because I do that no matter what. Facebook is just the feed for me for that. So,
you know, that's a good point. I'd bet money that that's still included, though. If you read news on Facebook and link out to something else, if you're still in Facebook, quote unquote, I'd bet that that still counts in that 50 minutes easily. I bet they're calculating that. So you know that's another really good point. People are getting their news that way now.
Yeah, and I'm sure they do because you know it's good for Facebook and for their revenue because remember Facebook makes money through ads, just like Google. So they want advertisers to think they're the number one, right? And that. Everyone's spending all their time on their site so they can charge more for the ads and stuff. But, yeah, I kind of use it as a news feed. I mean, I still have friend posts and stuff like that and read those. But, you know, that's really only 15, maybe 20 minutes a day. The rest of it's basically reading news. I would get through some other mechanism if it wasn't Facebook anyway. So,
right. Well, Facebook is one of these four organizations that we have former chief executive of Google, Eric Schmidt, saying, hey, these are the gang of four, the four companies that you should be watch that are really succeeding in different platforms with technology. He talks about how Google is one of them, Apple is another, Facebook and Amazon are the four companies that are really getting cash from customers, finding ways to reach them, developing tools. And I think it's interesting, part of the article in the Wall Street Journal also said, but you know, Microsoft isn't on that list. And he said, yep, consumers don't see Microsoft as the revolutionary here. They're looking to companies like Facebook and Apple and Amazon and Google. Weigh in on that. Jeff, why don't you start?
You know, it's kind of one of those things. They're the hot companies. They're the consumer companies. They're the companies that are still growing. And, you know, they said the same thing about MySpace and stuff back in the day. These companies will always be changing. IBM used to be it before Microsoft came across. So there's always newer companies. Once you get so big, and you've even seen this a little bit with Google and their parent company, Alphabet, now, having to, you know, discontinue stuff. You know, it's always this faster, smarter one coming up. Most of Facebook is through acquisitions of smaller companies now. So there always will be a company to replace this one. It's just a matter of time if they don't get gobbled up. And Microsoft's really just a business company anymore. I mean, it's not a forefront and a consumer type in their face company anymore outside of maybe a desktop OS.
When I look at that list, though, sure they're tech leaders, but they feel like vastly different organizations to me. I get it. Everybody wants to grab onto the consumer. Everybody wants to make money in that way, but they seem to have different perspectives. Am I wrong? Do they all have the same perspective? They just look different from the outside?
Well, they are vastly different companies. I think in one area of each company, they have figured out how to monetize data, user data, and user eyeballs, really. With Apple, it's ads that are in apps and selling apps, selling music. You know, they've got their hands in virtually every digital media cookie jar there is, and they figured out a way to monetize that. With the other ones, it's mostly ads, and so while it's different and they're different companies, they have all figured out revenue streams in their particular market, whatever it is.
Does it matter that he says consumers don't see Windows as an innovator, as one of these leaders, when I mean, there's been a, I mean, this is a big company and it's made a huge impact on technology.
Well, I can tell you it matters to Microsoft.
Of course.
And I don't know if I don't, if I completely agree with that. If you look at Microsoft from the standpoint of they're the maker of the Xbox, and how that is a very popular platform, and they have monetized the heck out of that. I think that list is probably not accurate and probably leaving off Microsoft's in that aspect, because they have monetized the heck out of Xbox, and I know that that's a huge revenue generator for them. Now, the problem is they can't do that on any other platform. They keep trying, and they keep failing. But they have locked up the set-top video game console thing, at least for now.
One of the things I like to do is try to relate technology things like this to something that is a little more, well, I'd like to say ubiquitous, but is a little more common knowledge. And so right now when we hear about Tesla being the advanced leader in car production technologies and that sort of stuff, that doesn't mean that GM still isn't a behemoth and that Ford isn't still a great innovator of technology. We just don't think of them like that because they've been around so long. They're so large. They're a mainstay. They're not producing these whiz-bang wow things that maybe some of these smaller companies are. But Microsoft will continue to, you know, make plenty of money even if they're not that innovator. And then I also think of Microsoft as a company, and I think of Facebook as an app. I don't think of Facebook quite so much as a company, really. Although obviously it is, but it's not something. I don't pull my phone out and say I need to jump on Microsoft real quick and do whatever it is you would do on Microsoft. So it's just a little different function.
Yeah, and you don't hear ads when a particular company is advertising something on TV. It doesn't say go to the Microsoft store and buy this. I mean, they don't say that. They say the Apple store. They might say the Google Play store, but they don't. Even though Microsoft does have an app store, that never gets mentioned. So another very good point there.
Sure. Well, and you mentioned, Amos, that it's not like Microsoft is just going away because one, you know, executive says, hey, they're not as much of a player. I think that's obvious when we talk about the fact that Windows on desktops is now under 90% of the computer systems that are being run. And at first glance, you think, oh, I think we misinterpret that statistic maybe, because it really is. It's still at like 88.77% of people are using this.
Anything else and any other statistic is striving to hit 88 point whatever percent it is.
Right.
I mean, the fact that you – it's interesting when it goes the other direction that it's under 90. I mean, that just speaks volumes to how big, how ubiquitous, how ingrained Microsoft is in everything. And you know, I know we're going to talk about it in a little while too, but, you know, moving to Microsoft Office, or not Office, Windows 10, and how, you know, some people are doing it, some people aren't doing it, and it's just kind of nobody's too excited about it. It's just kind of common everyday software anymore, and nobody gets too fired up about it because it's been around for so long.
But didn't we used to get excited about the Windows updates? Joel, you don't have to answer that question. But, I mean, Jeff or Amos, I remember when people were, I think they were excited for Vista, guys. And then, you know, things rolled out in that way.
Right.
Vista made them wish they weren't so excited in hindsight. But, yeah, we used to because there were big, giant leaps. In terms of operating systems, I mean, a big leap from Windows 98 to Windows 2000/XP, even from XP to Windows 7, there was a pretty good leap in terms of functionality, usability, speed, performance, you know, features. Windows 10 is more of an evolution of Windows 7. It's not that big gotcha. I mean, if Windows, you know, 10 came out with totally 3D monitor support, VR support, no more keyboards needed, all voice, you know, people would be excited for something like that. But it's more of an evolution of the OS versus a big leap forward like some of the other big operating system updates were. I mean, on the Mac side, if you go back to Mac 9 to Mac 10, that was a humongous upgrade, and everyone was super excited for it and stuff. But even then, and they used to have even, big updates with a lot of features. Even Apple's, it's more of an evolution now, the last two releases, than a big overchange where you get a brand new, humongous new feature you can't live without, so.
We do have a call, but right before we get to that, I want to make sure, Jeff, you wanted to mention that right now you can still upgrade to Windows 10 for free, but that doesn't last forever.
Yes, Microsoft has announced their end of free date for upgrades of Windows 7 and Windows 8 users. So if you are still running Windows 7 and 8, you can still upgrade to Windows 10 for free, but only until July 29th of this year. After that, it will cost you $119 to upgrade. So if you don't want to pay for an upgrade, make sure you complete your upgrade to Windows 10 before July 29th of this year. We all kind of knew it was coming, but we didn't know the exact date and the upgrade price, and now we do. So if you don't, anytime after July 29th, you will have to pay $119.
There is the public service for today. That sounds great. Let's talk to Dave quick from Pine Ridge. Dave, you have a question about file transfers.
I do. I have a computer at home that's, we're not hooked up to the internet here, but say I type a document or whatever, and I put it on a thumb drive or flash drive, and then I can take it to the public library and then print out the document. I guess just to start with, if I use that thumb drive or flash drive again, take that back and use it on my computer again at home, am I at risk for getting a virus or something like that? I don't have, I don't have any of the virus software on the computer.
A minor risk. There is a risk. There is some virus stuff that's designed, and including ransomware that's designed just to spread over USB drives. But it is fairly rare. The more public the machine you use to go print that off on, the bigger the risk is. I would probably get antivirus on the machine just to scan it. If you're going to do this off, if this is very infrequent, I wouldn't worry too much about it, especially since you're not on the network. Most of the malware is not going to run very well anymore without that being on the network. But there is a risk, a small risk, but there still is one.
Okay. Yeah, I would say it's really, really small. But, one thing if you could do before you go is you could delete the thumb drive, since presumably the documents are back home on your home computer. You could just erase or format the thumb drive where you are, and then there would be nothing on it. And while there would still be some risk, I suppose it would be a lot less because there'd be no files on it. So I guess that's one precaution you could possibly take, but... I would hope
that the public library would have some sort of antivirus on theirs.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
if there's a problem, chances are somebody else is going to be affected also, maybe even before you. So chances just so slim. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
I guess also I had a question about, the libraries now have, you can loan books, download books so many a month, and if I downloaded that to say like an MP3 again, is there a problem with you've got an MP3, can that get get messed up from malware? Or if it's something that got transferred even to a computer, say if I put it on a thumb drive and then put it on my computer at home again, it's just a download from the public library, just from, they give you so many a month. I guess, is there a concern there as well?
In a more general case, this is true of, it doesn't matter if it's an MP3, a PDF file, a doc file you get from someplace. It's all about the trust of where you're getting this. In this case, you're downloading it directly from the public library's resources. So I doubt someone put up a MP3 malware disguises an MP3. Always possible, but very, very unlikely. Any kind of data document can be infected or manipulated. It's a more matter of how much you trust the source of that document. And in the case of the public library, you're there. It's physically, local to you. It's a pretty highly trusted source. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. But just think about the source of the data, and that really will determine your level of risk.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate it. Dave from Pine Ridge had a quick question for us, and we'll go ahead and take a short break. I'm Keely Boltina filling in for Tech Radio host Kent Osborne. We will be right back, and we'll talk about Apple Music. What files are they being deleted from people? We have to mention Prince just a little bit to keep us all current on the latest buzz. And also, a 10-year-old walks away with $10,000 because he figured out there was a bug in Instagram. So I'm a little bit jealous. We'll be right back with Tech Radio. Welcome back to Tech Radio here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We are at the University of Sioux Falls, broadcasting from KCSD here, and I'm in for your regular host, Kent Osborne. In the studio with me, we have Joel Brovelite and Amos Asap, and we've got Jeff Litterick on the phone from Peer. Remember,
One thing I'd like to add,
yes,
from the end of the last one, trusting about sources, because this has came across, actually, my Facebook news feed, which we were talking about earlier, is any file you get, you need to validate your trust in that source. But sometimes that can fail. In fact, the ADA, the American Dental Association, sent out a whole bunch of these little cards to all their associate dentists in the association, and they all had malware on them. Basically SIM-type cards for their membership. So while this is very rare, it can still happen. I've seen hard drives infected with malware come from the factory overseas in Thailand and be shipped, and there was a big scandal about that a couple of years ago. Coming right on the hard drive as you buy it in the shrink wrap. So while rare, it can still happen. But in general, your chance of catching malware is how much you trust that source and how valid that source of that data is. So,
thanks for that clarification, Jeff. He's just finishing up a question that we had at the end of the last segment about transferring files when you're using a flash drive and how much that really puts your own equipment at risk. So we appreciate that. If you have a question, you're welcome to call. I will likely not answer it, but I will push it to the right expert that we've got on our panel. You can call 800-524-3604. You can email midday@sdpb.org, or you can find us on Facebook.com/techradio. And speaking of Facebook and its little company called Instagram, I have to talk about this. I know it might not be as rooted in tech language as you might usually talk about, but this 10-year-old has figured out that there was a flaw in Instagram where he could delete other people's comments, and Facebook says, "Hey, thanks for pointing it out to us. Here's $10,000. What? This is amazing. Joel, we were just talking about this before the break, and you said, yeah, but he gets $10,000. That's great. Imagine how much that saved Instagram and Facebook.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The man hours that it requires to trace down every little possible conflict and bug in the various platforms and all of that, they could hire 20 people and work them for half a year and may never pick that particular bug up. So more and more companies have been offering what they call bounties on either security vulnerabilities in their software or just flat out bugs. And that's what this was. And, he probably just went through the right channel and pointed it out. And they're like, yep, this qualifies. Here you go. $10,000. You'll probably be seeing more and more of this type of thing in the news. There have actually been lots of people collecting money by finding security holes. That's a job that you can have. But this one really, I think, hit people the right way because he was a 10-year-old kid.
Right.
But, I know people that actually do this as a hobby. You know, they'll try and find security holes in software and sometimes the cash prize can be up to $1 million or more. So there's money to be made in finding flaws.
Well, and that's exactly it too. There's money to be made in finding flaws, and if Facebook doesn't pay this $10,000, then there's the chance they're going to make money on the black market with that information.
Yeah,
right?
which is
if someone breaks into a system like just happened recently with Verizon, and you gather all of their customer data information and you take it to you know, the black market with it and sell that information, you're going to make money. Well, here is Facebook's attempt to, you know, even that out. Okay, tell us about it. Let us fix the problem, and we'll pay you some money too. So either way, you kind of, you know, end up doing some good.
Sure, you're doing good, but I mean, and maybe this is my bias, because when I hear the word hacker, I think, ooh, bad. That's not, I mean, it's not necessarily bad, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing everything on the straight and narrow either.
Well, sometimes vulnerabilities are just a very unique combination of coincidences, right? So, you know, maybe it's a combination of the browser and the computer platform and, you know, who knows whatever else it is that just hasn't been tried yet. And so maybe it was an innocent thing that he stumbled on. I don't know the specifics of it, although I did read a bit about it that said he did report the vulnerability in the correct manner, so maybe he knew what he was doing. But, you know, a lot of times these things can be stumbled upon and not necessarily found because someone was looking for it.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know how many vulnerabilities are found and just reported to the company as a regular user. Hey, this isn't working on this thing. Type, email it off, and no cash reward given.
Right. As opposed to the right channel to
yes,
get $10,000.
Exactly.
So,
well, it's all about how you know who you know.
Sounds good. Well, when we are looking at different media, social media opportunities and the way that people are using technology, I wanted to pick your brains about this concept of Apple Music. I was reading a blog post that some people are claiming that Apple Music is deleting their files, that it's that when you sign up for it, it scans your database of MP3s and WAV files and then matches them and then deletes the music that you actually own or, you know, have put onto your computer. So is this happening? Is this not happening? People are saying it's happening. How does this work?
Okay, it's totally happening. I have two things to say about that. First off, it happens with your permission because it doesn't do any of this until you agree to it. And it says,
so I have to read the terms?
No. It says specifically, it's not in the buried
the
in these
list.
Terms.
Okay.
It's laid out in a very step-by-step bullet point. We are going to remove the MP3s or the music from your hard drive. It's basically a feature. It frees up space on your hard drive, puts it in the cloud. You can access it from all your devices. Sounds great, is great, unless you have some very specific, you know, I see lots of examples of bootlegs. I myself have many, many bootleg concerts that, you know, I can't get anywhere else. And my solution was I just made sure I had a copy of them. Well, we call that backing up, which we recommend everybody does. And so once it does its hocus pocus on your hard drive and uploads what it can and identifies your music and then uploads this, what I should do is I should cover what it actually does. It goes into the iTunes store and says, okay, we have copies of all this stuff, so we'll give you access to it. Because you have it on your hard drive, you might have that Rattle and Hum YouTube CD on your hard drive, and they happen to have that on the app iTunes store. So they go, okay, you don't need this because you can access it from us anytime. And then it goes through and says, oh, you have Chaos and Disorder by Prince. We don't have that. We can't do that. So we'll upload that entire album to the cloud so that you can access it. However, now what happens is a lot of people have files on their computer, music on their computer that is labeled funny or labeled incorrectly or doesn't have all the meta tags. And so iTunes just tries to figure out what the heck it is. And one of the ways it does it, it compares it to a database using all of the track lengths and album and says, okay, well, this must be Music in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder because all the tracks line up. And it turned out it wasn't. And so it replaces it with the wrong album, mostly because you labeled it incorrectly or you didn't have a backup.
So
I feel no pain for any of these people that don't have a backup and can't read.
So we're back to back up your files.
Yeah, of course.
I feel like
had you done that,
every time. Right.
Nobody would have any of these complaints because they would be like, I lost 2,000 songs, but I had them on a hard drive right next to me, so then I didn't complain because I was okay.
So I actually hadn't heard about this until you started speaking about it. So I went and looked, and I do find an instance here where this particular, and I don't know if it's the same one you're referring to, is saying that Apple, she is an artist who does some of her own music, a freelance composer. And so there's going to be some of the files on her computer that absolutely don't exist anywhere else but her computer, right? And so what she's saying is that Apple didn't recognize it, which makes sense, so chose to take that file, upload it to the cloud, so then she's got it available to any iMusic, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Apple Music.
Just, yeah, whatever device you have,
Apple
whether it's
Music.
Windows.
So she can access it
right.
from whatever.
Anyway. But okay. then after it uploaded to the cloud, it removed it from her computer.
Which it told her it would do.
Okay, and so that's what the complaint is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I get that, especially for somebody who's a musician. You're like, you don't want those files just not on your computer. So if you're a musician and you use your computer for music, why are you not backing it up? I don't understand why you would do that. It's telling you it's going to do that. Receipt user, that's what needs to happen here.
And it does say that she got it back by using a backup, which is good. But it also says that Apple told her the only way for it not to do this is for her to stop subscribing to Apple Music. So apparently there's not an option to remove it from your computer.
So you have to agree to it to get it to...
Yeah, if you want to use this service, it's going to try and keep your music. I mean, it doesn't have an option for let's sort of use Apple Music and sort of use iTunes Match.
Sure.
Let's use it, you know, because who wants to get, you know, 47,000 prompts to say, is this... track okay? Is this track okay? Is this track? It's not going to do that because that's just not useful.
I think I should inject two quick things here off this article. One is you can always re-download it yourself, but you have to do it manually, song by song. So if you didn't have a backup, you could actually, except for the ones where it screws up the match, like a alternate version of a song and it replaces it with a more common one, you can actually re-download them one by one. But the bigger one that people should be aware of is the second you unsubscribe, all that music's gone. You cannot access it anymore.
And they tell you that very specifically. So you should have a backup.
Backup copies of everything. And I think this is going to bite a lot of people because a lot of people are going to be bitten by this one. Like, kind of like what she did. Now, she recovered everything because she had backups. But she points out a lot of people don't do backups. A lot of people are not going to pay attention that, well, I was just unsubscribing. One of her problems was you can then no longer play these when you're offline. She's offline
unless you've
a lot.
Downloaded
right, cause unless right. you know restore
yeah,
them to
yeah.
where
you, you know, so. I agree with you, Jeff, except for this isn't going to bite them in the butt because this has been how it's been doing this for, I don't know, a year and 3 months, however long Apple Music's been. This has
I
been
think
doing
there's
this.
A good class action lawsuit coming down the pipe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Certainly
somebody's going to bring a lawsuit. I can't see a judge not throwing it out because they lay it out and say, you need to do this. And if you unsubscribe, it actually says that in there. When you don't subscribe, all of your music will be lost. Back up your system.
Well,
I mean,
and I suppose what happens, you know, whether Joel's right or Jeff's right, or it's somewhere in between with what people, how this impacts people. I mean, if people continue to subscribe, even if it would be a problem for them, if they subscribe to this service,
maybe they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't have any idea, and it won't actually impact them because they continue to subscribe. And my understanding from all of the surveys and the data that's been released is that's how people want to get music now. They're really turning to these streaming services as opposed to purchasing music, just like we went from buying CDs to buying the individual songs. Now we're moving from buying the individual songs to, I just want access to everything, and I'll pay you a flat fee so that I have access to everything.
Yeah, and you know, I should say there is a solution for this for anybody that wants to say you want to subscribe to Apple Music, but you still want to have a library that has all the stuff that you can't get anywhere else that you want to save. Just create a new profile, a new user, and have a separate iTunes account. Bam, you're done. You can have on the same computer a couple of different profiles, and one can be the one you use for Apple Music for you and your family or whatever, and the other one can be your hobby / musician, whatever profile, which I would highly recommend if you do it for a business anyway. I don't know if that's your job. I don't know why you're trying to mix those two things. That just seems like a terrible idea.
So maybe I shouldn't just click yes to everything I'm prompted.
Yeah, you shouldn't
just
assume everything's going to be all right. Yeah, absolutely. Even if they didn't tell you, if you have stuff that you don't want to lose, you need to be careful with that at any point, really, no matter whether it's music or family pictures.
We have a couple of minutes left in this segment, and Joel, you're not wearing any purple today, but you are the one who... he shows me his Apple Watch that has the symbol that Prince changed and apparently the background on his phone. So I stand corrected.
What?
That he's... I'm trying to transition into talking about Prince here, and I was...
What did
he's
Prince
in,
do?
Like, blue and... You know, just released a little bit of music and then, you know, died recently.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, crazy.
Weird.
I wasn't sure if you had heard about that because nobody had talked about it.
No.
But, you know, you mentioned this is the first tech radio since
it is.
The untimely death of Prince. And he was one of these artists who was vicious about the rights to his music and how people heard it and where they got it and, you know, how he was able to maintain that. And one of the elements of that is that he wouldn't let his music go on these streaming services, but that's how people are listening to it. So even when he died, people are going, hey, I want to listen to Purple
Rain.
Well,
all of his music is available on Tidal,
sure.
Which is the, you know, kind of musician-led mm-hmm. streaming service. And as a matter of fact, when he signed up on Tidal, he really went all in. He did amazing things where he would release an album that was never released, and he would release it for 12 hours, and you could listen to it for 12 hours, and then it would come off of Tidal. Very like Prince to kind of tease things and put out alternate versions. You know, the big deal with Prince is early on when he got his first contract at 19 years old, although it was reported he was 17, he was actually 19. You know, the Warner said, okay, you can't release more than one album a year. Well, that doesn't work for Prince because he could release an album a month. He was very prolific. So that was a big problem for him. And releasing music on the internet, people forget he was the very first major artist to sell music on the internet. He had a dispute with Warner and released a 4-disc album that you could only get on the internet. He also was the first artist to use the internet as a distribution method solely for distributing his music. He had a NPG music service that you could subscribe to, and that was the only place to get music for a very long time. So he was really at the forefront, but later on, you know, the famous thing you've heard is Prince said, the music is over, but they never, the internet is over. They never finished the rest of the quote where he said, music is over on the internet. And I think what he meant by, well, not I think, what he said is what that means for artists is you can't make any money selling music on the internet. And that's the problem. And that's why I won't use these services. That's why he used Tidal, because they basically pay double what any of the streaming services do.
Yeah, but if you're not a musician, do you care? If you just want the music.
Of course not. No, absolutely. And I agree with you there. You know, Prince flat out said, I would rather sell 40,000 albums and get all that money myself and get the product to my biggest fans,
your
he called them friends,
sure.
Then sell 4 million albums and get 10%, which is what you get when you're an artist. You know, he can release, and he would do, he would release 4 discs all at the same time. And he, because they're all produced and all run by him, he got all of the money. And this seems like, oh, this is very esoteric and he's a weird guy, but that's what people do now. They just release albums. You know, you're talking, whether it's Kanye West or whether it's, the Canadian guy, Drake, that's his name, Drake, Tim Horton. Drake really just decided to release an album. Beyonce did the same thing. They just said, I've got this album. They release it immediately, and the tracks are available for download or stream immediately through certain services. So that's the influence of this type of thing. And I think we'll see more and more, you know, as things go on, his influence on music and the internet is going to be pretty long-lasting, I think.
We're going to move on to the last third of the show here in just a minute. So I wanted to give you a chance, Amos or Jeff, if you had anything to say about Prince, we're not coming back to him. So anything you can't – I just got a thumbs up. That's all I got. So that works for us. We'll go ahead and take a quick break. We have our panel of tech experts here in the studio for Tech Radio. I'm Keely Boltina, in for host Kent Osborne. We're going to talk cybersecurity when we come back in just a couple of minutes. So stay with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thanks for sticking with us here on Tech Radio. Kent Osborne, your host, is off today, but I'm Keely Boltina in with the panel of tech experts, just chatting about a few different things in the news related to computers and technology and social media. Amos Asif is still here in the studio with me, and we've got Jeff Litterick on the phone. Security is a topic that frequently comes up on Tech Radio, and this week, SDPB's Nate Weck talked cybersecurity with some experts in the field. I want to play a part of his discussion with Jeff England with Silver Star Communications.
Somebody wants to come up to you and say, well, can you explain to me what cybersecurity is? How would you explain it to them?
Well, for me, it's a two-part answer. The cybersecurity on its own, of course, is just keeping critical information, whether it be intellectual property or it could be personal information that exists in this digital space, to keep it protected from those who would wish to do harm with that information. And so at its base element, I think that that's what it is. But really, from my perspective, it's more. It really starts coming into risk management, because I think any company, any government entity that believes that they can keep that information 100% secure all of the time is fooling themselves. So the better practice then is to recognize that there's a risk that's there. What do we do to make the likelihood of that information being compromised as least likely as possible? And then are there other things that we could do by looking at it differently in different ways to make it such that if that information ever were to be compromised, that it would be meaningless to the wrongdoers who are going after that information? So for me, the reason why I say it's a split answer is because, of course, one, it's keeping information secure, but on the other side of it, it's just making sure that you're managing. It's a risk assessment and a risk management proposition from my perspective.
10 years ago, when you kind of look at where technology was to where it is today, how fast is it moving? And are there new risks that pop up, not maybe just on a daily basis, but on a multi-day basis? Is it tough to grasp some of that?
You know, it can be discouraging, I think, if you don't expect that there will be constant change in this space. And so, yeah, I mean, things are changing, right? So 10 years ago, maybe the worst case was somebody just is not very careful with their password and makes it easy to dial in. And we've seen movies that kind of portray these types of stories. And you know, and then, of course, there's always the threat of these 14-year-olds who are kind of bored and they just want to kind of pound into some of the easy systems to get into. And those are always going to be there. But, you know, you start seeing more sophisticated things now, right? So you've got, like, ransomware is one of the ones that's really been happening a lot the past couple of years, where you might inadvertently click a pop-up box on a web browser where somebody takes your computer file information hostage, and you've got to pay them in the form of bitcoins in order to gain access back into your machine. And then it doesn't ever entirely eliminate the software that's taking that hostage in the first place. And so those are some discouraging things. But what's encouraging to me as well is that the free market responds to these things very quickly. In some environments, as I've been talking with people, they create what they call a virtual desktop environment, where your laptop is just basically a terminal that's accessing into something that's on the cloud, whether it be a private server, a private cloud, or a public. Now, all of a sudden, if I get a ransomware attack, all I do is shut the machine down and I call the cloud provider for my virtual desktop. They destroy it and they issue me a new one, and all of a sudden I'm back up and running. And so there are some cool ways that the free market is responding to help address these risks. And so there'll always be new ones and there'll always be new solutions. But the encouraging thing is that there's always some cool, creative way that pops up to keep that commerce going.
Just regarding the whole cyber atmosphere today, what's the most challenging thing to a man in your shoes?
Well, keep in mind, my shoes, I'm the CFO, so I'm not an IT guy, and I can't really speak to specific threats that would perhaps exist, but I do understand the cybersecurity in the context of risk. And so, you know, some of the risks I think that are there that maybe you don't even think of, it's well-intended legislation that might potentially harm our internet service providers. It seems like that one of the threats that you have is that discussion between industry consolidation versus independent operators on a widely connected network. I think, honestly, one of the biggest threats in my mind is that right now there, I don't believe there's enough attention on the government side to consider the going after the ones who are causing the problems. There's a lot of attention on service providers. There's a lot of attention on the software makers to keep that information secure, but there's really not as much talking about the fact that somebody is a bad actor who's going after this information. Now, I understand it's almost in a pure academic sense, but let me give some context. If there is a domestic attack on my data, it's a criminal act. The same way that you would have if somebody broke into a department store and stole physical goods, breaking into somebody's network with intellectual property is a criminal act. And then to take it even further on an international scale, if I've got a merchant ship that's crossing through international waters that is where there's a state-sponsored attack on that, it's an act of war. And so what is the role of government in this? And that's really one of the things that I think needs to continue to be investigated as to how do we actually go after those who are causing these problems, because right now, you know, our computer environment, it makes it very difficult to find out who those people are.
Jeff, we just have about 2 minutes left. I want to just let you weigh in on what he said.
Well, I mean, everything he covered is pretty much right. I mean, you know, it's the day we live in with the number of attacks going on and stuff, and the philosophy you kind of have to take in order to protect yourselves in the current, especially as a business. Maybe not so much as a consumer, things are not as inevitable, but as a business, there's a lot about risk assessment and management and detection, realizing that there's a lot of attacks going on out there and that at any one time you could be a victim.
Amos?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Security is all about risk, right? I mean, just having your computers turned on is taking some sort of risk. We often talk about the only secure computer or device is a computer that's turned off, unplugged, encased in concrete, and thrown in the ocean. And so it's just at what level of risk you're willing to accept, and for those things you're not willing to accept, how far you're willing to go and how much money you're willing to spend in order to reduce or remove that risk. So, yeah, it's all about the risk.
And I should mention again that was SDPB's Nate Weck, who was talking with Silver Star Communications' Jeff England. We'll post his extended interview about cybersecurity with England on sdpb.org. And we just have a short window left. Amos, I wanted to let you mention another SpaceX landing. Give us the quick line by line.
You know, I thought it was cool. I don't think people give enough credit to what it takes to send a rocket up into the air and have that stage one fall off and land on what's relatively a little tiny piece of boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and have it land vertically and safely and not fall and crash. But they did that again this morning, and with a little more accuracy than they'd previously done, and it turned out pretty good. And what this does is it paves the way for cheaper, faster, better space transport, which would include things not only for military and civilian purposes, but also for space travel too. So this is the beginning of advanced space items for the average person.
Not likely a topic that will escape you in future tech radio discussions. That sounds great. That does it for this edition of Dakota Midday Tech Radio. As always, thanks to our technology experts on today's panel. Joel Brovelite was with us, Jeff Litterick, and Amos Asib. Thanks also to Nate Weck, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey with SDPB. In for host Kent Osborne, I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and enjoy your weekend.